Good morning, Dr. Ross, world traveller. You're back in Australia.
I'm back in Australia, mate. It's lovely to talk to you.
Likewise. So tell us a little what you went overseas for again. You were launching a tribiotic.
Yeah, look, I'm the chief medical officer of a company that sells high-quality nutritional supplements into China. And last year I designed the first tribiotic that this company had. But since then, I've moved to an even stronger bacteria that has a profound effect on metabolism. Now, what a tribiotic is, it has prebiotics which feed into healthy bacteria. So, for example, people, everyone knows about onion and garlic, and everyone's heard of sauerkraut and kimchi, the Korean stuff. All this stuff is very strong fermented prebiotics that feeds high-quality foodstuffs into healthy bacteria. So this is why we constantly say everyone should be having 2 or 3 pieces of fruit per day, 3 to 5 servings of vegetables per day, because the fiber and the plant chemicals and everything else feed into healthy gut bacteria. And less than 10% of people do that. So that's why so many people have gut dysbiosis and other problems with their guts for other reasons as well. All the synthetic chemicals we're exposed to, the multiple course of antibiotics, there's so many reasons why we have this gut dysbiosis. So the prebiotic component is very important. Secondly, you've got to have the right probiotics. Now, the probiotics are basically just the healthy bacteria that live in your gut. And good quality probiotics, one of the problems with them, if you just take a standard probiotic, most of the bugs are just broken down in your stomach acid. So we've designed this tribiotic so that the bacteria get through the stomach into the intestine and can set up shop in the large bowel where most of these bacteria live. And then finally, what we've done, the postbiotic are the healthy compounds that healthy bacteria make. So to give you an example, a lot of people don't realize this, but serotonin, which is the happy chemical, 90% of serotonin is made in the gut. So if you've got a dysfunctional gut, then you're not making proper serotonin. So it's one of the reasons there's rampant depression in our society is people aren't having their fruits and vegetables. They're not making proper serotonin, and so therefore they're getting depressed. So it's really important that these bacteria make good quality stuff. So healthy bacteria make anti-inflammatory products that damp down inflammation in the body, whereas pathogenic bacteria, that gut dysbiosis, puts pro-inflammatory products into the bloodstream. So there are three really interesting things we call short-chain fatty acids, which are things called butyrate, pyruvate, and acetate. They're the healthy postbiotics that are made, as are all these other anti-inflammatory chemicals that I'm talking about. And this particular bacteria, what this does is create a very healthy mucus layer along the lining of the gut to restore gut health.
I often say, if you have a question for Dr. Ross, send it in. We get lots of questions, but sometimes we just don't have time to ask all of them. Because you've been OS, I thought what we do today is let's ask some more questions. You mentioned kimchi.
Yep.
Pete says, I'm just wondering if my making and regularly eating kimchi, is this a good gut health food? And would Dr. Walker recommend this as a daily food intake to stay healthy? That's from Pete.
Pete, you're doing absolutely the right thing. Yeah, can I tell you, I've got two best mates. One of them is retiring now, but he was Australia's top paediatric surgeon. And this man absolutely loves food. He's a big boy, and he loves his food. And there's only one food he can't stand, and that's kimchi. Everything else he loves. But kimchi is so good for you because it's one of the top prebiotics that gives you the healthy bacteria. So, Pete, please keep eating your kimchi. Have it every day. It's very, very good for you.
Misha says, Dr. Walker talked about CBD oil, including with THC, as a treatment. How does that stand with someone who has schizophrenia in their family?
Oh, look, the thing is, smoking marijuana as opposed to taking oral CBD with a little bit of THC is a completely different thing. So when you smoke a joint, and I've never even done a Bill Clinton, I think I've seen marijuana once in my life. So someone had it and I'm thinking, what the hell are they doing? why anyone would do it is just beyond me. But if you smoke a joint, you're getting a concentration of THC somewhere between 5 to 25%, and the more pure the THC is in the joint, the more it does your head in. And there is a direct link between schizophrenia with that dose of THC. But the THC that's in CBD oil is in such small concentration that it purely balances the receptor. So it's not going to do anything to promote schizophrenia in this situation. It's a completely different thing. It's a bit like you have a headache. You take 2 Panadol, it takes away your headache. If you take the whole box, it kills you, knocks off your liver. So it's all to do with dose. And THC in a small dose is not going to hurt anybody. The problem is, and this is what, and I can't really answer this one because I don't know how much a little bit of THC would test on a drug driving test. So just say the police stop you and check you, and they check you if they can see whether you smoke marijuana or whether you've used some sort of ecstasy or things like that. So I'm not sure if a tiny bit of THC in CBD oil is going to show up on that test. I don't know. I can't answer that question. And if it did, I think the police should ignore it personally, because this is what I feel sorry for people who are getting great benefits from CBD oil with a bit of THC. And they're drug tested and they could get charged, which is just ridiculous. So I'd like someone to tell me the answer to that one, because I've been trying to find out what dose will show up on a drug test. I just don't know.
Alice says, what can cause low blood pressure, and is low blood pressure worse than high blood pressure?
No, the answer to that is that the blood pressure we were designed to have. So if you look at the 5 hunter-gatherer races left around the world, their blood pressures, even when they get into their 60s, 70s and 80s, their blood pressure doesn't go much above 120. But some people are naturally walking around with a blood pressure of 95 over 60 and they have no symptoms. And it takes the strain off their arteries and their heart. It's very, very good to have a blood pressure of 95 over 60 unless you get very dehydrated or very hot. Then your blood pressure can drop too much, and that becomes an issue. But the question is, and this is to answer Alice's question, the question here is, what is the cause? So do you just have physiologically lowish blood pressure that's good for you, which we all should have, but we don't because we live in this society, or is there another potential cause for it? So I'll give you some examples. If you have a condition called a cardiomyopathy, which is a heart muscle disorder, so your heart's not pumping properly, well, you just can't generate enough of the blood pressure. So a lot of these people have blood pressures of 90 to 95. They get a bit dehydrated and they just go down. Other people can have what we call vasodepressor syncope, where their blood pressure is okay sometimes and then it drops markedly. Other people, especially as they get older, have a thing called postural hypotension. So their blood pressure when they're sitting down might be all right, but when they stand up, it drops down to their boots. And then, interestingly, there's a relatively uncommon but still well-described condition called Addison's disease. And Addison's disease is a disorder of the adrenal glands, which are the little glands that sit on the kidneys. They're basically our stress glands. So the outer bit of the adrenal glands makes cortisone and cortisone-related products. And so if you took the adrenals out, both adrenals out, the right and left, in someone, they'd be dead within 24 hours because they couldn't generate a blood pressure. And the inner bit of the adrenal glands makes adrenaline. So if your adrenals are failing for some reason, then your blood pressure drops. So just say, for example, you've had some autoimmune disease and been given steroid therapy. The steroid therapy then suppresses your normal steroid function coming out of the adrenals. When you stop the steroids, your adrenals don't work properly and you can markedly drop your blood pressure. So to summarize what I've just said, do you have a specific heart condition? Do you have just what we call vasodepressive syncope, where the blood pressure just drops? It's not actually a disease, but it's a reflex abnormality. Do you have adrenal dysfunction, or is there some other less common condition that's dropping your blood pressure? Or if you've got low blood pressure, you might be bleeding from somewhere, as an example.
All right, Alice, lots of answers there for you. I suggest you go and have a serious chat with your GP first. Eileen says, this is about kidney stones, Ross. Eileen wants to know what is the main cause, if there is one single main cause of kidney stones, and how can you prevent getting kidney stones? Is there a couple of things that you need to do?
Absolutely. It's a great question. And over 90% of kidney stones are due to a thing called calcium oxalate. So it's not the calcium, it's the combination of calcium with this oxalate that does it. So if you measure a 24 urinary oxalate measurement in these people with kidney stones, you find it's quite high. So I say to all people, and can I say about kidney stones, in terms of pain, it is the worst visceral pain possible. So to the top few, number one is kidney stones, number two is gallstones, number three is pushing out a baby, and number four is a heart attack. So they're the top four organ pain. So somebody ripping your arm off is going to be a lot more painful than anything. But I'm saying in terms of organ pains, they're the worst pains you can possibly have. Possibly a ruptured aneurysm in your brain would be pretty bad as well. It'd be up probably number five. So kidney stones are incredibly painful, usually caused by calcium oxalate, but there's pyruvate stones where you get an infection in the kidneys and that can generate these particular calcium pyruvate. There's also calcium urate, so gout can cause kidney stones as well. Calcium phosphate can do it in certain cases. There's certain rarer things. You can get cystine stones in the kidneys, but the main thing is calcium oxalate. So I say to everyone, if you possibly can retain the stone and get it analysed and find out what it's made of, that's important, because it's important then when it comes to the management of kidney stones. So the first thing, if you're prone to kidney stones, and I believe kidney stones should be one per customer. I don't think you should ever have recurrent stones. And if you do, you really need to start preventing them. Number one is to stay hydrated. So if you get dehydrated, that can really precipitate a stone. Number two, go to the internet. Just put in foods that precipitate kidney stones. You'll see things like rhubarb and spinach. So even though rhubarb and spinach are good for you, they have a lot of oxalate in them and they can markedly increase your risk. But also things like soft drinks are bad for you, whereas tea and coffee is quite good to help prevent kidney stones, and a little bit of alcohol, not too much, of course. So processed foods are very bad in this department. People say vitamin C can increase your risk of kidney stones. I don't believe that. I don't agree with it. But in terms of drug prevention, if I have patients who have calcium oxalate stones, especially thiazide diuretics, which are used for the treatment of high blood pressure, can actually block the oxalate being precipitated in the urine. So I use thiazide diuretics, and the best one there is a thing called chlorthalidone or Hygroton. You also have to take a bit of potassium citrate, which also helps prevent the kidney stones. So I any of my patients who have kidney stones, I always get them onto these programs so that they don't have to go through it again, because I can tell you it is so painful.
I can tell you we are going to get so many emails from people saying, what did Dr. Ross say you have to take? So could you say that again, please?
Go to the internet, look at the foods that you should avoid if you've got kidney stones. So foods you should avoid, things you should encourage. There's some very good lists, which I don't want to go through now. Secondly, the main drug is a thiazide diuretic. And I think the best one for kidney stones is a thing called chlorthalidone, otherwise known as Hygroton, Hygroton. And taking with that some form of potassium citrate. So those things work together, because you see the Hygroton takes the potassium out of the body. So the potassium citrate gives you some potassium back, but the citrate also stops the oxalate from precipitating.
Thank you for that. There was a couple of times where you have given out information and advice, and I've come on at the end and said, now look, Dr. Ross said this today. If you missed it, you can do one of two things. You can listen back to the podcast, or you can send me an email. Now, Ross, every time I do that, my email box fills and I spend probably the best part of a couple of hours pasting the details and replying to people's emails.
So my comment then is, please just listen to the podcast again. The poor man's busy enough.
Reg. Hello, Reg. I like the name Reg. Reg says, I know what I'm supposed to eat. I listen to you all the time. But how can I continue to eat the things that I enjoy eating which aren't healthy? Is it a case of everything in moderation, or are there just certain foods I should cut out of my diet completely?
Yeah, look, I don't think there are any foods you should cut out of your diet. Can I say, I talk about the 19 out of 21 rule. 19 out of 21 rule is very straightforward. For 19 meals out of 21, you follow the program. The other two, you relax it a bit. If you can't have your Friday night pizza, or what I have is a thing called the cheesecake rule. I love cheesecake. So I would have a piece of cheesecake probably once every 2 or 3 months. And when I do, I enjoy every bite and don't feel a shred of guilt. And look, as a kid, I used to enjoy a meat pie. So I'll occasionally have a meat pie. I know it's not good for me, but one thing you can't measure in your bloodstream, Reg, if you're listening, is a thing called pleasure. And we're not just here to exist. We're also here to have a bit of fun and a bit of pleasure. And part of that pleasure for all of us is going to a nice restaurant or having foods that occasionally we shouldn't be having, ice cream and things like that. So the point about all this is just don't do it all the time, because it's people who eat foods like this all the time become obese, get all the sorts of problems that go with obesity. There are so many illnesses related to that. So it is important to eat good quality food. And it's also not what you shouldn't be eating, but it's what you should be eating, as I say all the time, the 2 or 3 pieces of fruit, the 3 to 5 servings of vegetables per day. Less than 10% of people do that, and they're the healthiest people on the planet.
As I say to my wife, I would hate my last meal on this earth, if I die tonight, to be kimchi. So therefore, let's have some cheese and red wine.
Oh, absolutely. No, I'm with you on that one.
Laura says, I take fish oil tablets every day, but I read recently they may not prevent a heart attack. Is this true? And could you ask Dr. Ross, what are more beneficial, fish oil tablets or krill oil tablets?
Two very, very good questions, Laura. And can I say, I read the study that came out and said, oh, fish oil might be bad for you. And when you actually read it, it was a bit of nonsense, the whole thing, because they were grading people based on how healthy they were or were not. And as they went more up the unhealthy scale, that's when they started to see the benefits. Now, there's a little known place in America called the Mayo Clinic. And the Mayo Clinic published a few years ago in Mayo Clinic Proceedings an analysis of all the fish oil studies. And they found that the fish oil studies up to 5 years, fish oil did absolutely nothing. But when they looked at the studies that went beyond 5 years, there was on average about a 20% reduction in cardiovascular disease in people who took fish oil supplements. And I'm a great believer in supplementation. So I'll give you an example. There's a test you can have called the omega-3 index, where you do a pinprick blood test, put on a bit of blotting paper, send it off to this company who measures your omega-3 levels. Now, the average omega-3 index, so these are the omega-3 concentration in your red cells, the average omega-3 index of Australians is 4%. The average omega-3 index of Japanese people is 8%, okay? Obviously, because the Japanese eat more fish than we do. But I will make a confession that I think I've confessed to you before. I don't like fish. I don't particularly enjoy the taste. And it's just something that I don't like. I encourage all my patients to eat it, especially if they enjoy it. But it's a bit like Reg's question. If you get no pleasure out of something, why would you eat it? Mm-hmm. So I take a bucket of omega-3s every day. So I had my omega-3 index tested. My omega-3 index is 11.9%. Now, a few years back in the New England Journal of Medicine, a study was published based on the omega-3 index. If your omega-3 index is 4% or less compared to people whose omega-3 index is above 8% or 8% or more, there's a 90% increased risk for sudden cardiac death in people with a low omega-3 index. So I'm a great believer in people taking fish oil or krill oil. I tend to suggest more krill than fish, only because with krill, you take 1,000 milligram capsule every day, one capsule a day. Fish oil, you'll get the equivalent if you took one to two twice a day. It's all to do with the omega-3. So when you take a fish oil capsule, it's 1,000 milligrams. That's only 180 milligrams of omega-3 in a different form than it is in krill. But there are some newer forms of omega-3 coming out that are much more powerful. And again, I can't specifically mention products, but it's look, the point is to take some as opposed to not take them at all. But don't do it for a few months. And this is the problem with most Homo sapiens. If I line up 100 people, give them any treatment at all, after 12 months, 50% have stopped. I'll put people onto a supplement and I'll come back and say, are you still taking that? Oh, no, doctor, it was a bit expensive. Didn't think it was doing much. Forgot to reorder it. And they've stopped. The patients in my practice are the ones that do the best are the people who follow the 80-10-10 rule. 80% is lifestyle, no doubt. 10% is the appropriate use of pharmaceuticals if you need them, and 10% is the appropriate use of supplements. So don't think that taking your fish oil is going to override your desire to exercise. No, no, no. You've got to do the exercise. You've got to eat the right food. You've got to be happy, not smoke, sleep well. Do all those five keys of being healthy. That's 80% of your management.
All right, Ross, our time is up. I better let you go. That was fun.
Good on you, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
As always, mate, thanks a lot. Look after yourself and we'll talk to you next weekend. Thanks, Ross.
Thanks, mate.